please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Deputy Public Defender Karen Nakasone on behalf of Defendant Appellant James George Plikta. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Right.
Thank you. Your Honors, in this case, a new trial is necessary because there was a violation of statute and a violation of constitutional rights. Evidence was admitted in this case in contravention of HRS 704-416. This evidence was accompanied by a limiting instruction that blatantly contravened the same statute, and this was all done in violation of my client's constitutional rights to a fair trial, to mount a defense, and in violation of his self-incrimination privilege. This error in this case was created by the prosecution, it was exacerbated by the court's limiting instruction, and it then placed the defense in a difficult position of having to move for a mistrial due to the circumstances that had been created by the first two errors. And the court, as a final point of error, the trial court abused its discretion in not granting the motion for mistrial, and in not granting the mistrial, the court missed its opportunity to correct the situation that the trial court had created by allowing the first two errors to occur. The IC's SDO that was issued in November was gravely erroneous on two main grounds. First being that the ICA ruled that the applicable statute 704-416 did not preclude the state's cross-examination here. We beg to differ. The statute did preclude the cross-examination here, and in the alternative, it clearly did prohibit the limiting instruction that was issued here. And the
Nakasone.
Yes.
You characterize or articulate the question presented before us in that regard as whether the ICA gravely erred in upholding the state's attack on the defendant's credibility at trial with prior statements defendant made to the three panel of examiners. What prior statements are you referring to?
We're referring to the prior statements. One of the points that the state raises that I think Justice Levinson is getting at is that the state argued in their answering brief that these were not statements per se. Our position is...
I'm simply reading your words.
Okay.
And asking you what statements you're referring to.
They are referring to the incompleteness. They are using what he failed to disclose to the three panel, and that's still use of his prior statements to the three panel against him to impeach at trial.
What statements?
The statements, the entirety of the prior statements made to the three panel.
Did the jury hear the entirety or any of the statements that the defendant made to the three panel?
The jury, I think through the testimony of the doctors, they heard what the defendant had described. But the problem here arose...
You have no quarrel with that, I take it, or do you?
That the jury heard the statements?
With the testimony of the members of the three panel.
Our quarrel was when that same line of questioning, what he omitted from telling certain details that he left out.
You focus exclusively, do you not, in your claim of error, trial error and grievous appellate error, on the questions that the prosecuting attorney asked the defendant. Isn't that so?
Yes, but we also...
You haven't raised as error any testimony that members of the three panel gave.
We did attach it to the opening brief that the same...
In your application for writ of certiorari.
In the application, no, but there is reference within the application to see Appendix B of the opening brief. The opening brief, we did attach everything that we believed infringed upon 704-416. And what was attached in the opening brief was the entirety of what we believe was an offending cross-examination. We also attach pertinent portions of the rebuttal examination that the state conducted of Dr. Wade and Dr. Gitter, where the state pursue that same line of question. Dr. Wade, Dr. Gitter, did he ever mention aliens to you when you spoke with him? That's within Appendix B of the opening brief, and there is a reference in the application to that.
All right, so your quarrel with the testimony of those two mental health care professionals is limited to their responses to the question whether the defendant had mentioned aliens at all.
Well, there's that, and we also raised the point of the limiting instruction, which the ICA did not rule on at all. We raised as a specific point of error the limiting instruction violated the statute, and that they gravely erred in not ruling on that specific point.
In your view, the failure to say something is a statement for purposes of 704.416?
The failure to say something when you're attacking the incompleteness or the deficiency of what he said to the three panel, that's still an attack on the statement. Meaning you have to use what he didn't say in his statement in order to attack what was there. So our position is that it's still an attack on the statement. And using the statement to attack credibility is something that the statute absolutely forbids.
Is the prosecution permitted to adduce evidence of communications between the defendant and the three panel for purposes of contesting the defendant's defense of lack of penal responsibility? That is to say, the defendant's defense that his mental condition was such that he lacked penal responsibility.
The prosecution can properly attack the doctor's opinions and the doctor's conclusions by what the defendant may have omitted from his account to the doctor about what happened. So that's fair game.
Isn't that exactly what the prosecution did?
No, in this case, our position is that they didn't use it to attack the doctor's conclusions or opinions. They use it to imply that Mr. Plicta had not been truthful about whether he even had delusions on that day. So it was, the error that I think
isn't
is
the relevance of that conclusion that Mr. Plicta did not, in fact, lack penal responsibility.
That may be the effect of the conclusion, but here the trial court said,
I mean, it's not a matter of attacking the defendant's self-defense claim, which is separate and apart from his lack of penal responsibility defense. It's directly impugning the viability of the defense itself.
Okay.
I mean. How can you do that other than by attacking the credibility of the factual foundation for the defense itself?
Again, we believe that the prosecution's options are not absolutely foreclosed. They can go after the doctor, the reliability, the facts that the doctors relied on, the adequacy of the materials the doctors relied on in formulating the opinion. So the doctor's conclusions and opinion is fair game for cross-examination.
Including what the defendant did and did not say.
But see here, the trial court said you were specifically to use this responses, the defendant's responses to that whole line of questioning, what he left out. You are to use that for credibility purposes only. If the trial court had said mental condition, you know, that would be more in line with what the statute would allow, but here it was specifically for a purpose that's outside the scope of the statute.
So Nakasone,
your real beef then,
have some chance to speak to.
Come on. Finish your question.
So your real quarrel is with the imprecision of the court's words in its limiting instruction with respect to what use the jury could legitimately make of the testimony that the defendant gave on cross-examination.
That's one of our main points, but, you know, our first point of error was that evidence should not have been elicited. It was designed to impeach. Now, you know, what's dicey in this case is that the impeachment was about mental condition, but we're saying that the instruction itself, the plain language of the statute, and the statutory purposes would all prohibit the type of impeachment use that was done here, even if the impeachment was for mental condition. The plain language of the statute says you cannot, it's not admissible for any other purpose aside from mental condition. The plain language forbids this type of impeachment use. The statutory purposes of safeguarding the defendant's rights, instilling the defendant's confidence in examination, preventing unfair use of the statement in subsequent proceedings, encouraging the defendant to speak freely during the examination, and preventing unfairness. All of these statutory purposes would not be served by allowing this type of impeachment attack to be mounted and completed by the prosecution against the defendant when he gets up and testifies to some detail that he, what we submit, inadvertently left out. Did Justice Acoba have a question?
Well, so concerning your last point, you know, assuming that 704.416 does not cover matters that the defendant didn't provide to the examiners, what limitations are there on what can be told to the examiners? What limitations are there on the use of the statement at trial?
I mean, assuming that the statements were properly admissible.
Well, the statute sets out limitations on what is admissible with respect to the statement, right? So what are those limitations?
The limitations would be, well, the plain language of the statute says you can't use it for any other purpose.
Other than what?
Other than a mental condition. And here the instruction said something totally different. It didn't say limited use for mental condition. You know, and the, if you look at the...
So if you ask a defendant what he didn't tell the examiners, what implications arise if that's permitted with respect to the examination?
If they're allowed to cross-examine the defendant about stuff he left out,
the stuff he didn't say.
Or the stuff he didn't
say. The prosecutor says, well, did you tell the examiners that this happened on January 1st, 2002? Or did you tell the examiners that you threw a rock through the car window? What are the implications for the examination if the prosecution is allowed to do that?
Well, I think if the prosecution is allowed, you know, free use of what he said or didn't say. What he didn't say. Then for any defendant going through a three-panel examination, it's going to create a chilling effect on the right to exercise the defense, to explore this defense. No lawyer is going to want their client to go through a three-panel if anything that they don't say could be used against them at trial, and that implicates a constitutional right to mount a defense.
So what would the ordinary defense counsel do if what was permitted in this trial would be permitted in future trials?
Yeah, I think they would be extremely hesitant to let their client go through the examination. You know, they may ask
Do they have a choice?
No, that's the whole problem here.
They don't have a choice.
If you want to use insanity defense, you must go through this process in this state.
So the examination is court ordered.
The examination is court ordered.
So the defendant doesn't have a choice.
Yes, but to participate in this examination where he has no control over the form, control, or content of the examination.
If in the future trial courts allow questioning about what was not told to the examiners, what would the ordinary defense attorney be compelled to do?
They they might not want to explore the insanity defense if, you know, the client maybe is not the best history.
They have the insanity defense. That's something they need to go and argue. What would the ordinary defense attorney have to do?
Are you talking about at trial?
Or for the examination?
For the examination, maybe they might want to insist on a complete, almost like a Miranda. You have to warn the defendant, you have to warn my client that anything he leaves out of this interview may be used against him at trial.
So then what would the defendant have to do in the examination?
He would have to speak freely without any time constraints and he would have to be advised that anything you leave out can be used against you at trial.
So then does the examination turn into a recitation of what the legal theory of the defense is?
A recitation of what the legal theory is. I'm not sure. I don't know if I understand the court's question.
Well, if the defense knows that if they don't provide a full statement of what the prosecution might ask the examiners, then would, in order to avoid being impeached through this method of saying, what didn't you tell the examiners, then wouldn't the defendant have to provide extensive information during the examination?
Yes. Yes, they would create a burden on the defense to provide every single detail.
And what effect would that have on the examination?
I think the problem is that the way the examinations are structured now, the defense has no control. The doctors control what questions are asked. And they can even control how far the defendant is able to respond and how much.
So that would conflict with what the doctor's methodology might be in terms of examination.
It could interfere with that. And that undermines one of the purposes of the statute, is you want to encourage free speaking so you get an accurate diagnosis.
Aren't those all foundational problems as an evidentiary matter?
You mean when they do the
objection, Your Honor? Lack of foundation for the question. There's been no groundwork laid for the circumstances under which the examination was conducted, the extent to which the healthcare professional controlled the colloquy, whether the defendant was allowed to volunteer statements. In the absence of that foundation, I object to the question.
Yeah.
Did the trial counsel at any time make a foundational objection?
Not as complete as how you just described, but she did say that no one gave him the time until this jury to listen to his whole explanation. And she clearly said, it's not that he told anything different.
This is argument or this is an objection?
This was in her objection. Yeah, so I believe it's in the application. It's also in the opening brief. But the problem is,
if you explore what the defendant didn't say, would you then become or run at least a substantial risk that you would have to disclose the statement for purposes other than to show a medical or physical condition or to prove guilt?
I guess, yes.
Is that contrary to what the statute permits?
I believe so. It's unfair for the state. In this case, they tried to imply that he had lied, where it's clear he has no control over the form, content, or length of the examination. And in this case, he did disclose most of the delusional thoughts to Dr. Stojanovic. And it's not within the four corners of the trial transcript, but it is in Dr. Stojanovic's written report. Most of the delusions.
Does he have any control over how the examination goes?
No, he does not. He just has to, the defendant himself testified, I just had to answer what they asked me. And that's how these examinations go, and he did explain that at trial.
So is it fair to place the burden on the defendant to disclose what the prosecution at trial believes is material?
Yeah.
In a situation where the psychiatrist or psychologist determines what is essential for his or her evaluation?
No, it's absolutely not fair. And in this specific case, the errors were more egregious, and the unfairness is that five minutes? Okay, 10 minutes. We are asking someone like Mr. Plicta, who was found to be clearly psychotic by a majority of the three panel, we're asking someone who was found to be clearly psychotic at the time of the incident to give a full and accurate disclosure of what his mental state was. And if he doesn't fully disclose, or he fails or forgets and he leaves something out, then that opens him up to a credibility attack at trial. Our position is that that's grossly unfair, and fairness is one of the statutory purposes. It says to prevent unfairness to the defendant. And under statutory construction, the court must apply and construe the statute in a manner consistent with its purpose, and the statutory purpose is not furthered by permitting this type of impeachment attack that was done here. And I'd just like to, I think I only have a few minutes left, I would just like to address why the errors herein were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. They were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because there's a reasonable possibility that the errors herein contributed to his conviction. The state may come up and says, you know, there's overwhelming evidence refuting the insanity defense such that the negative impact to his credibility was marginal, and that it didn't matter. But we submit that it did matter enough such that the errors were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Because 3 points on this. The three panel in this case was all over the place. The evidence, their opinions were conflicting. One doctor said no psychosis. One doctor said depression-induced psychosis. And the third doctor says methamphetamine-induced psychosis. So where you have the three panel with conflicting opinions, there's a reasonable possibility that the errors might have contributed to the conviction. Second point, a credibility attack under these circumstances where you had an insanity defense and evidence of prior intoxication. A credibility attack on the defendant in this case was particularly damaging because the three panel is relying in some part or in large part to the defendant's own statements about when he last used ice, when he starts reporting depressive symptoms. So the state is able to gain multiple advantages from their credibility attack on Mr. Plicta, and that violated the statute and his constitutional rights. The state was able to argue that he lied about his crazy beliefs, that impacts how the jury assesses the insanity defense. They were able to argue that he lied about when he last used methamphetamine, that impacts how the jury assessed the voluntary intoxication question. They were able to argue that he lied to the three panel, that of course impacts how they viewed and assessed the insanity defense. And finally, they were able to portray him as a liar by using these statements unfairly against him, and that was disastrous for the defense. So where you have that situation like we had here, evidence of prior intoxication and an insanity defense both at play, there is a reasonable possibility that the errors herein might have contributed to the conviction. And the third point here being that insanity was the one and only defense Mr. Plicta had. The instruction told the jury, you can use this responses for credibility only. What that tells them is you can use these responses to determine whether Mr. Plicta was lying about his delusions or whether he was truthful. And when the court told the jury to consider this evidence for credibility only, in a case where the one and only defense is insanity, there is definitely a reasonable possibility that these errors contributed to Mr. Plicta's convictions. And do I have 1 minute? 6 minutes and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Does the court have any further questions? Or I'll just close right now and save my time for rebuttal. None. In this case, Your Honors, the state completed its textbook execution of a credibility attack on the defendant. They did it through the cross-examination of the defendant, through subsequent questioning of the two rebuttal witnesses by the state, and they did it, finally, they brought the point home during closing argument. And this execution and completion of the credibility attack on the defendant herein was all done with the aid of the court's limiting instruction. And all of this occurred in violation of the statute 704-416 and in violation of Mr. Plickta's constitutional rights. And for all of these reasons, we respectfully request that this court grant him a new trial.
May it please the court, James Anderson for the state. As a threshold matter, Your Honors, if defendant made statements regarding alien notions to the three panel, such was proper under the statute because it went to his mental condition. If he did not make those statements, which was ultimately proven at trial, the statute isn't even implicated. I don't think that impeachment is prohibited by the statute. I think any time a person testifies to a matter, his credibility is at issue. And that's what happened in this case. The only reason why this occurred, this incident, this impeachment occurred, was because defendant filed a notice for penal responsibility. Defendant elicited evidence on direct examination that the reason his conduct was based upon his feelings of alien notions.
Excuse me, Mr. Anderson.
Absolutely.
Did the defendant testify that he told the examiners about these aliens or humanoid?
He said he testified he told Stojanovic and Wade, I believe.
Well, he said he told Stojanovic and Wade.
And Wade.
On cross-examination, right?
Yes, I believe so, yes.
So on direct examination, he never said, I told the examiners that they were humanoids or aliens involved in this incident.
You're right, he did not, yes.
And so the impeachment was based on the fact, I guess Dr. Wade and Dr. Gitter were called in rebuttal, is that correct?
Exactly.
On their testimony that he didn't tell them that.
Correct.
So he never made the claim, though, that he told them that.
He did at the end of cross-examination. During cross-examination, then subsequently on rebuttal, he was impeached.
Yeah, he didn't make that on direct examination, right?
No.
He never made that claim.
No, he didn't.
Was Dr. Stojanovic ever recalled?
No, he was never recalled.
Why not?
I don't know, because defense had Sir Rebuttal. They recalled defendant. They could have called Stojanovic, but they did not.
Well, you recalled Gitter and Wade, right?
It was our witnesses, yes.
Right. Okay.
I take it, Mr. Anderson, that it's your position that, well, first, I mean, you've indicated that in your view, the statute is not implicated with respect to non-statements.
Yes, I agree.
With respect to whatever it is that is admissible, statements. The admissibility is limited to the issue of the person's physical or mental condition.
Correct.
And that extends to impeaching the defendant with respect to statements made regarding physical or mental condition.
I would agree, and I would agree.
And impeachment goes to credibility generally.
Absolutely.
Did there are credibility questions, obviously, that transcend the narrow question of the defendant's mental condition.
Okay.
So, did the circuit court err in limiting, in instructing the jury that it could consider the defendant's statements or non-statements for purposes of credibility in general, as opposed to for purposes of determining the defendant's mental condition in particular?
I would think not, and I'll tell you why. I think, first of all, that when the instruction itself was not erroneous, and it certainly didn't affect any substantial rights, but it was perhaps premature. I think when any witness testifies to any matter, his or her credibility is at issue. And the matter at issue here, without doubt, was the defendant's mental condition. The questions and responses only went to whether, you know, part of his mental condition, whether he informed the doctors that he was of his alien notions, which he testified to on direct. I think it became very clear to the jury later on when the jury was charged, when the court gave its general credibility instructions, which indicated that the jury could accept in whole or in part the a witness's testimony, and gave several reasons how it was the jury was to ascertain credibility, determine credibility, including inconsistencies in testimony and things like that. The jury also was informed that when a defendant testifies, his credibility is to be determined as any other witness. So no, I don't think that instruction precluded them, the jury, from understanding that what was at issue was the credibility of defendant's claim that he was substantially impaired.
If the prosecution legitimately elicited the testimony from the defendant regarding what he did not say to the three panel, did that open the door to the defendant adducing evidence of a prior consistent statement?
Sure. Sure, but only with respect to the three panel. It didn't matter whether he told anyone else, but the three panel, that was at issue, I think.
Well, the relevance of the non-statement or statements to the three panel was that this subsequent testimony at trial was a fabrication, isn't that so?
Absolutely.
All right. Doesn't that directly then open the door for evidence of a prior consistent statement to somebody else preceding the arguably inconsistent statement?
Okay. I'll give you. Yeah, I'll
right.
I'll
if that's
that.
True, why was it not error to allow defense counsel to withdraw or in the alternative not to withdraw, but still to testify in detail as to what the defendant told her?
I think the defense got exactly what it wanted. It seemed to agree that she couldn't become a witness in the case. Toward the end of the colloquy with the court, I agree, I can't become a witness in the case.
That was once her motion to withdraw was denied.
Exactly, but she seemed satisfied also with the remedy that she was afforded, and that is that she could ask defendant, to whom did you've heard the prosecution say that you never mentioned these alien notions before. Did you ever do so before? Yes, I did. To whom? To you. So in that regard, he was rehabilitated. I don't know what else they would have said, I mean, except in detail, but certainly the rehabilitation occurred. And I think at that late stage in the game, in the trial, the court couldn't have abused its discretion in denying the motion for mistrial and denying the motion for withdrawal. It was too far, and counsel should have known long ago that she knew obviously what he said to the three panel, and if she heard what he said to her, then she knew that there was going to be a problem here, especially if he testified to it on direct examination about these alien notions. She should have withdrawn long ago.
Excuse me. Yes, does the defendant have any choice in terms of going into the examination?
Not if he files. Not if
so
he files
no
a motion.
Choice, right? He's ordered by the court.
He has
to
a
take part in the examination.
He has a choice, yes, not to go in, because then he would not file a motion for, you know, to determine his penal responsibility.
Assuming he has the right to prepare a defense or to make a defense, right?
Yes.
And one of the defenses that he can rely on would be the insanity defense.
Correct.
So if he chooses to raise the insanity defense, then the statute requires him to take part in this examination.
Absolutely. There's no other way to discern that.
So that's why 416 limits the use of what statements are obtained from the defendant in this examination.
Right.
So they're limited only to medical and physical condition.
Physical and mental condition, yes, Your Honor.
And any admissions of guilt are excluded.
Any admissions, actually, as to the charged defense, like in Domingo, the self-defense claim.
The question is whether the defendant told the examiner something. That question is not a question of mental or physical condition, is it?
It goes to the, it's not a statement, no. So it wouldn't fall within the statute at all.
Whether he said something to them or not. I had coffee this morning at 9 o'clock.
That has nothing to do with it. Right?
Yeah, so that's, that is, and that's, doesn't have anything to do with a medical, I'm sorry, with a mental condition or physical condition.
True. Right.
So the purpose, though, of limiting the information that can be used at trial is to facilitate the examination and diagnosis and, if necessary, treatment of the defendant.
That and not to impinge upon his Fifth Amendment rights, his self-incrimination, right.
And so
primarily that, I think.
I'm sorry?
I would say primarily what I just said, yes.
And so the idea behind all of this is to ensure that the defendant is cooperative in order to facilitate diagnosis and treatment by the psychologist and psychiatrist.
Sure.
And the statute provides that the psychologist and psychiatrist can use any method that they wished to use. Is that correct? So that in effect the defendant has no control over what is inquired into in the examination?
You know, to a certain extent, yes, because they have to run a battery of tests on him and they ask certain questions. But both Wade and Gitter did testify, I believe, that if defendant had blurted out these things, these alien notions, they would have listened to him and entertained him. So to that, in that,
there's nothing in the statute that says he has an obligation to present his legal theory in front of these examiners, right?
I would think that would be subsumed, Your Honor.
No. Well,
not legal theory.
They control, well, the defendant says, I got cut off, I got redirected, etc. Somebody took an hour and a half, so somebody else was briefer than that.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Okay.
He said, I never had a chance to get into, humanoids or whatever, aliens.
That's what he said, but that's not what the doctor said.
Well, but the statute says, in effect, that the examiners control. Is that correct? They control the examination.
Yes, sure.
So that the examination is not a stage at which the defendant is supposed to come up with his legal theory or set forth his legal theory.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I would think that he could definitely, especially if they're so heavy on his mind, he would definitely state what made him crazy.
So there would not be anything that would require or that you would expect in terms of the defendant proposing during the examination. I mean, it's not a time for the defendant to be making his case. It's a time for the psychiatrist or psychologist to be conducting what they consider is a relevant examination.
I think that is, subsumes that, Your Honor, that the psychiatrists are looking at what he has to say. And if he mentions something about alien notions, they're going to listen.
And if the defendant starts reeling off his legal theory, would that have an impact on the examination or the way that examination is conducted?
I'm not sure I follow, sir.
Well, then if we adopt the rule that the trial court adopted, then at trial, would the prosecution would be able to examine the defendant about every or any facts concerning the incident with respect to whether he told that to the examiner?
Only if it related to his physical or mental condition, yes.
Yeah.
Only.
Whether he told them about his, about the aliens or humanoids doesn't relate to his mental condition.
It does relate to his mental condition.
The fact that he told them or didn't tell them goes
Absolutely.
To credibility. It doesn't go to his mental or physical condition.
Oh, I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that's fair at all. Because that's what drove him, he said. He said he reacted in this manner because of the alien notions. So of course that went to his physical or his mental condition.
And if you permitted this to happen, I suppose you think that wouldn't undercut the purpose of eliciting cooperation by the defendant so that the diagnosis and treatment of the defendant would be facilitated.
But that's the purpose of it, to ascertain whether he truly is substantially impaired. So we would
expect. Wouldn't be an impediment, you think, to the diagnosis by the examiners?
Of course.
Is that
not.
Correct?
Of course not. Of course not.
Regarding the issue concerning defense counsel taking a stand as a witness, withdrawing as counsel, instead of declaring a mistrial, could the judge, under the circumstances of this case at that time, allow counsel to have done that?
And given a brief continuance, I see, something like that. It could have.
Right, depending on whether or not it was a substantial hardship. And in this situation, would it have been a substantial hardship to stop the trial declare a mistrial and...
No, I don't know. I don't know if I could answer that, Your Honor.
But it's, yeah.
But it was pretty near the end of the trial, so...
That could have been done.
It could have been done, but I don't know if it was necessary. I don't know if you could say that the court abused its discretion, disregarded principles of rules and laws.
Certainly, don't you feel that the impact of counsel taking the stand, taking the oath, and testifying that indeed the defendant did make that statement to me prior to, would be more impactful than the defendant just saying, I told my attorney.
I don't know if it would have achieved any more, because she not only elicited from his in testimony, but she also argued the point too. So I don't know if it would have made any difference, Your Honor. Okay. If the court has nothing else.
When you say she argued it in final argument, what exactly did she say?
I believe she said at the end of her closing that, the state has made much of the fact that he didn't tell the doctors this information about alien notions, but he did. He told me about it, So I think the rehabilitation was complete. I don't think anything else was necessary.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How many minutes?
5 minutes.
Thank you.
Just briefly, Your Honors. Whether or not he said something, whether or not he mentioned something in his prior statement to the three panel, the state just said that that's not within the purview of the statute. And again, we would point out that whenever you are using a statement to show what somebody left out or what is missing from the statement, deficiencies of that statement, you are still using the statement, and it is for a purpose that the statute does not allow. And
in allowing this procedure, does that pit the examiner against the defendant? If you can call the examiners in to testify as to what the defendant didn't say, as opposed to what he did say, does that make them, in that sense, adversaries, pit the examiner as against the defendant?
It could, and you may very well have a defense counsel saying, don't let them cut you off when you're in there talking to the three panel. You say everything that you need to say and do not let them cut you off.
So does the examination then become something other than a place to try to make a diagnosis or come to facts for treatment?
I believe injecting this antagonistic, you know, component into it, where the defendant's trying to say everything he can because whatever he leaves out can be used against him, and the examiner, by contrast, is trying to get through the examination as fast as he can because I think, like Dr. Gitter said, he does one of these, he does one almost every day. I mean, that's, he does like 20 a month. I mean, that's the volume that at least that examiner was working with. It's not conducive to getting a full and accurate diagnosis, which is what one of the statutory purposes is, to instill defendant's confidence in examination so you can get an accurate diagnosis. So it would be counterproductive to that statutory purpose. And, you know, like just in following up on the non-statement point, anything that's missing from a prior statement is fair game for impeachment. You know, our attorneys that do the abuse trials, if the officer gets up and says, oh, she had redness around her neck, but that recordation of that injury is nowhere in the police report, you bet the defense counsel is going to get up there and says, now, officer, you, and this, the police report is a prior statement of the police officer. You said in your police report, you wrote your police report close to the time of the incident. It would be important in an abuse case, officer, would you agree to record every salient detail about whether she had injuries or not? Yet, this injury is nowhere in your report, is it, officer? You know, that's classic impeachment, and that is what was done here. You are impeaching with the prior statement to show what is missing from it. That's an impeachment attack under 613.
But I thought you agreed earlier that impeachment was not foreclosed by 704.416 as long as it went to statements relating to or relevant to the defendant's mental condition.
Well, if impeachment with the use of the prior statement is any, I'm sorry if that's what I conveyed, that's not what I meant to convey. Our position is that impeachment with the use of the prior statement is absolutely forbidden. So
what sort of cross-examination is possible then under 704.416 with respect to what the defendant did or did not say to the three panel?
You can't cross-examine the defendant about what he omitted, but you can get out from the doctors and attack the doctor's opinions by what the defendant may have omitted from his statement to the doctors. So the doctors...
I thought you told me earlier that it would not have been error for the circuit court to have given the jury a limiting instruction with respect to the testimony that was elicited from the defendant, that it could consider that testimony only for purposes of determining the defendant's mental condition.
That would have been more correct, and if that had occurred, I think we would still be standing up.
It would have been impeachment testimony, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's why we would still be arguing on appeal, at least the first point of error, that we would probably be arguing in that situation the instruction was still not enough to mitigate the damage caused by the impeachment attack by the admission of the statements in the first place.
If the introduction into evidence, not of what the defendant said, but what the defendant didn't say, undermines the examination process or subverts the examination process or procedure, then that information or that evidence would not be admissible at trial for any purpose. Isn't that true?
I think so. It's only admissible under the statute if it pertains to mental condition. If it's going toward credibility in any way, shape, or form.
Well, we're talking about statements not made as opposed to statements made. So statements not made, I mean, there's just no, the universe is open for statements not made.
Right.
And so it would subvert the examination process if you were to require the defendant to engage in reciting every conceivable fact that might be pertinent to the case, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yes, it would lengthen the process, and we submit that's an unfair burden to place on the defendant, especially in a case where somebody is trying to assert an insanity defense. So, I think I'm out of time. So, I'd just like to let the court know that Mr. Plicta was very gratified that this court deemed it appropriate to take a closer look at his case. And so on behalf of Mr. Plicta and myself, we thank this court for the privilege and opportunity of presenting for argument on the merits today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This court will take this matter under advisement.
That is the wording that the trial prosecutor did use. However, as I was stating, in fact, it is distant and distinct from the Allen type instructions that are typically given or have been given, or that Fischardo refers to, because of the two things that it does not do. It does not try to single out the minority and try to sway them to the majority, and it does not to matters outside of the evidence for the jury to consider. It doesn't tell them that the case necessarily is going to be retried or anything that was otherwise inaccurate.
I don't think the appellant is suggesting that the trial court's response was literally an Allen instruction.
But it didn't have the effect of an Allen-type instruction either, in that it didn't do either of those things. It didn't have. It didn't ask the jury to look at stuff outside of the evidence, merely to just continue discussions with each other regarding the evidence. And I think that's the anything that we want the jury to do is just make a considered judgment based on the evidence. And I think that's what the court accomplished here by giving this instruction. It didn't try to sway one way or the other the jurors to change their views. In fact, by giving page 16 of the instruction, it was specifically instructing the jurors not to sway their views, just to get a verdict.
What about the statement, I forget, in Fajardo or Beleza, that says a hung jury is a safeguard in the criminal justice system? So by giving this instruction, that would preclude hung juries, wouldn't it? I mean, the jury says we're deadlocked, what next? And the court says, continue the deliberations. And I don't think page 16 saves it, you know, because page 16 only reiterates and buttresses the instruction to continue to deliberate, because all it says is how you're to deliberate. So it doesn't save that instruction. What about that? If you have this kind of instruction that says, no, go ahead and deliberate. Is that a violation of the proposition that hung juries are a safeguard?
I don't believe so, because, again, this just goes to the trial court's discretion, and it is defined as a broad discretion. And the court is required to weigh all the options that we had previously discussed, and actually, I think court did express that it did take those considerations into mind, and there's nothing in the record to otherwise show that the court did otherwise.
I apologize in advance for asking the question I already asked, but I'm having a senior moment and I forgot your answer. If the trial court had inquired of the jury whether further deliberation would be of assistance, and the jury had responded, we are deadlocked, we are hopelessly deadlocked, and we will always be deadlocked, would the trial court have committed an abuse of discretion by instructing the jury to continue its deliberations?
It would not. It's within the broad discretion of the court to weigh the factors. I think one of the factors that the court may I finish?
Yes.
One of the factors that the court may consider, and only one of the factors, is whether it believes the jury is, in fact, hopelessly deadlocked. The other factors are for the court to consider on what to do at that point. Thank you. And for the reasons that we've stated today, we respectfully request this court to affirm the decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Well, 4 minutes then. I know the order that when they accepted the writ, it directed us on the issue of the jury instruction, but since the topic of whether there was sufficient evidence for the parental abuse, the parental discipline instruct defense to apply, I'd just like to address just real briefly here. Chief Justice Moon indicated that the daughter lied. I think it's not just the daughter lied at the time that deserved punishment. He lied about the grades, and about the report card, about attending tutoring. But she lied every day of that quarter that she did not attend the tutoring classes. The mother thought she was at school attending classes. She was at the shopping center hanging out with her friends.
Mr. Tommy, her daughter didn't go to school for several days after the parental discipline, is that correct? How many days did the daughter stay home?
I believe it was 3 days.
Why did the daughter stay home?
The way the facts present itself, the mother looked at the bruises. According to God, the mother looked at the bruises. They looked bad. And then she said, no, you're not going back to school. Yes, she tried to hide the fact that she hit her. In her mind,
the school generated the...
Yes, the school generated...
...abuse complaint, did it not?
Correct. So on Thursday, I think on Thursday, when she went to school, they saw the bruises or the marks still remaining. They inquired.
So days after the administration of parental discipline, the bruises were still significant enough to cause Castle High School to call the police.
Right. After they spoke with the daughter or with the student, they would call the police. Now, the fact that the bruise didn't heal, I don't think is, you know, maybe a factor for the jury to decide, but at the time, this is what happened in the van. Okay, she lied about attending classes every day. She was hanging out at the mall or at the shopping center. And when the mother tried to discipline her with the objects, she wasn't aiming for her arm. She tried to hit her thigh. The daughter blocked it. Grabbed another item, tried to hit the thigh again. That's what she was aiming for. More likely, if the daughter just took her punishment, we may just have had one strike at that point. But she kept on. She kept on trying to deflect it, because I guess the way that they're seated, she's in the driver's seat, and she's not in a very good position. But each time she tried to discipline her, the daughter said, basically, no, I'm not taking any of that.
And Mr. Tommy, the mother's in the front seat.
Correct.
In the driver's seat.
Right.
The daughter's in the back seat.
Correct. In a minivan, is correct.
Okay. So it's not like the face is within reach anyway, then the thigh would be the part that would be...
Correct. So that's where she was trying to aim. And then, again, when we look at the factors in how and what level of punishment she wasn't aiming to hurt her. She was trying to hit her thigh. It's just almost akin as to trying to spank the person in the behind. I mean, she wasn't trying to cause marks. She wasn't trying to injure her. She had enough of not just lying in that van, but she discovered she was lying every day. I mean, for a quarter, we're talking 2.5 months. I mean, she gave her the opportunity to stay after school. She used it to go with her friends to the shop. Now, she did attend tutoring, so I don't imply that it was every single day, but it sure sounded like maybe 4 out of 5 days she wasn't attending tutoring. And the grades reflect that, that's for sure. So, the parental, I'm sorry, I guess my time is up, but if the court is going to consider the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, I believe that the defense proved that there was parental discipline and was justified, and I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We take this matter under advisement.